Atheist Nomads, episode 384. Speaking of God with D.B. Ramsey.
The podcast you're about to listen to includes cursing and talking about hoo-haws. Please be advised.
Welcome to another episode of Atheist Nomads. I am Dustin, and in a little bit, I'll be joined by Dave B. Ramsey. He's a former minister who has published a book called Speaking of God. You don't know shit. And yeah, it's a really good discussion about his background and the book and, you know, his story as a Baptist pastor. And, you know, there was a lot more back and forth than in a lot of our interviews because a lot of his story was resonating with me and we were got a lot of back and forth going on with that, which was, you know, we both really enjoyed. So I hope you'll enjoy the interview as well. We do have a live stream coming up on December 20 at 2 o'clock p.m. Mountain Daylight Time, or Mountain Standard Time, and it will be our annual War on Christmas, or War on the War on the War on the War on the War on Christmas, whichever version you want to look at it, episode. They'll be taking place even closer to the winter solstice than Christmas. So be ready for that one, and I do have a... Dustin off the degree already planned for that. So it should be a good one. So go ahead and feel free to join us. That's December 20 at 2 p.m. Mountain Time. You can find details at atheistnomads.com/live. If that's not up by the time you're listening to this, I will get that up really quickly. Definitely by that point, it will be at atheistnomads.com/live. And in other opening thoughts, really all I've got is Trump is continuing to do his same stupid bullshit. He is still claiming that the election is being stolen. The votes have been counted. They've had like 30 or 40 different lawsuits at this point, most of them being dismissed or withdrawn, and only won one of them, and it was insignificant, didn't change anything. The votes are all certified now. Every state has certified their votes. But he's claiming that the election is being stolen. Well, he's trying to pressure Republican state legislatures into overturning the vote and sending their own slate of electors, which means what he's trying to do is steal the election. Because if there's one thing we've learned throughout the last, at this point, realistically, 5 years, if Trump is calling foul, he's describing what he's doing. That's basically what he's done the entire time. He calls people phonies. While being phony about calling them out for being phony, he talks about claimed that Joe Biden was panicking because of the pandemic, hiding in his basement, while Trump was also panicking, hiding in the White House. Yeah, Trump is the proverbial pot calling the kettle black at every single moment. And it's crazy that he keeps getting away with it. Fortunately, we should be done with him soon, and that will be good. And we're still in the middle of the third wave of COVID. And I hope you guys are all doing okay where you're at. Here, we're still doing well, but our local area is on the verge of we're within 2 weeks of needing to go to crisis standards of care at the current rate of COVID spread. It's getting really close. Last time I mentioned that, they're looking at mid-January. Now they're looking at late December. Just keeps creeping up. And Central District Health, because the way Idaho does health departments is it's split up into regions, not per county. Central District Health covers 4 counties, including the county that Boise's in, and then the one that Mountain Home with the Air Force Base is in, as well as a couple up in the mountains, including which gets Idaho City and McCall included in it. And they've been trying to hold a meeting to be able to discuss and vote on changing their public health advisory to a public health order at the request of the hospitals because they're about ready to collapse. Both meetings have had to be called off partway through before they could get to a vote because of protesters. In Friday's meeting, the police had to show up in riot gear to respond to the far right wing anti-mask protesters. And with the one on Tuesday, one of the members of the board had to leave and go home to make sure her 12-year-old son, who was home alone, was okay, with protesters banging on the door of their house. It got bad enough that the Boise City Police Chief asked the mayor to ask the Central District Health Department to end the meeting because of how bad the protests were getting in too many places. This is bullshit. People protesting, trying to control a virus. They're afraid about their freedoms being taken away. We're trying to make sure that if they get in an accident because a drunk driver hits them, that the hospitals can take care of them. That's the point that we're at. And these people are fucking selfish assholes who just want to complain and cry foul about anything and everything. And the Idaho Freedom Foundation and all of their friends and members are a cancer that is doing a ton of damage here. It is one of the reasons why the spread is continuing like it is here, is there is a vocal group claiming that wearing a mask is violating your freedom and threatening the safety of public officials who are willing to try to address this. That's fucking bullshit. All right, so I know that was a little heavy. The interview is not. So take a quick break and then we'll have the interview. And we are now joined by Dave Ramsey, the author of Speaking of God, We Don't Know Shit, A Former Minister Reflects on God and Religion. Dave, welcome to Atheist Nomads.
Thanks for having me, Dustin.
All right, so this book, and yeah, I only read the first couple chapters, but yeah, interesting tone. And, you know, going through your story. So, you know, you were a minister.
I was a Baptist minister for 10 years. I had two congregations in Virginia, one in Charlottesville, where the University of Virginia is, and another in another small college town, Farmville, Virginia, where Hampton, Sydney, and Longwood colleges are.
Okay. And that was quite a while ago, too, right?
24 years ago, almost to the day I walked away and started my life over. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and so for me, because, yeah, I was a theology major, did a year of seminary, well, three semesters, so basically a year and a half, and walked away and started life over as well. But that was 13 years ago at this point. So doing that in the mid-2000s, a lot easier than I would imagine it would have been in the 90s.
Well, I walked away in 1996, and I didn't know what was ahead of me. I had actually, right out of college, had worked for Xerox in sales for 2 years as a religion major, by the way. And that's another story in itself, mm-hmm. how I beat out all these business and econ majors at Carolina and State and Duke with a religion degree to get a sales job, which at the time is the brass ring or a brass ring in sales. So I returned to that world and then went to work for a competitor and then kind of moved along to other companies in technology, including Dell, Cisco Systems, and I currently work with the world's largest cloud technology company. But it was daunting, to be sure, because when I walked away, I did not have a job. It took me almost a year to find something. But for me, it was a matter of integrity. I could no longer stand up in front of a few hundred people every Sunday and existentialize Christianity and God, and so I walked away.
All right. So when would you say that the doubts started?
Well, we all have doubts. Any believer who says he or she does not have doubts is lying. It's just a known fact of life. And I always thought that the louder someone protested their lack of doubt was probably a big clue that they had serious doubts. Mm-hmm. It's not popular to talk about our doubts. Frederick Buechner, whom I quote in my book, says that doubt is the ants in the pants of faith. It keeps faith alive. And so, even as a child, I questioned the notion that unless you had heard of the name Jesus or believed in Jesus Christ, that you weren't going to heaven. And I would even ask my Phi Beta Kappa minister, so what about the people who live in the bushes of Africa? They've never heard the gospel. What about them? And, you know, his artful dodge of the question was, well, that's one of the mysteries of the faith. So that question always loomed for me in terms of the doubts.
And that's actually, that's a funny one, because in the church I grew up, Seventh-day Adventist Church, they have a concept called present truth, where you are judged based on what you know. So if you've never heard of Jesus, then you're just judged by how good of a decent person were you with what you knew to be right. And so that helps not have those kinds of objections.
Yeah, I actually, I mean, if you're going to accept the premise of, you know, a denomination or a theology, that's not a bad premise.
Right.
Because I knew a lot of Christians, and I had members in my church who were, can I say assholes on this?
Yes.
Podcast?
Oh yeah, you can cuss here. That is okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I would not want to be in heaven with some people that I knew. But the doubts, Dustin, that really began my move away from ministry probably began 2 years into my second congregation. That's when I really struggled and gave myself another 2 years to come to terms with it. And at the end of the day, so I had already kind of made peace with Christianity and the things that I learned in grad school that you don't get in the pulpit, you know, in a Southern Baptist church growing up, and you can't unring those bells. And most ministers are more liberal than their congregations, those that have been through theological education. It's just a natural mm-hmm. byproduct. Some don't take scholarship into the pulpit. Others do. I did. So I've already made peace with Christianity and who Jesus was for me. But the doubts about God got louder. And I reached the point where I said, I don't know anymore. And I don't think we can know. And if we can't know, the very next words that we utter are necessarily, inescapably conjecture.
Right.
But you may believe, you may hope, but you do not know. And once I reached that conclusion, it was the beginning of the end.
So that started when you were doing your undergrad and graduate school studies, right? Or did it just... That was the cracks that got it started later.
Well, the doubts about Christianity probably began in grad school. I really, my faith wasn't challenged. I did undergraduate work at Wake Forest, majoring in religion. My faith wasn't challenged there because I wasn't taught to think critically there. You were taught to find the wavelength of the professor. And then if you wanted to make an A in that class, you had to parrot back what that professor was thinking or where that professor was coming from. At Duke, I began to have professors asking me the question, what do you think about this, Dave? And I was, for the first time in my life, encouraged to think critically. And it was at Duke where I was introduced to the theology of a New Testament scholar named Rudolf Bultmann. And Bultmann's whole program of New Testament scholarship was demythologizing the New Testament. Bultmann mm-hmm. believed that you had to scrape away the layers of myth in the New Testament, which he saw as a heaven above, a hell below, to really get at the kernel of the gospel, which at the end for Bultmann was an existential Jesus, the teachings, the sayings, et cetera. And that, and moreover, at Duke, I was exposed to the notion that the resurrection of Jesus may also be a myth. Mm-hmm. And that one really was a kind of a slap in the face, because for me and for many Christians, the resurrection of Jesus is the linchpin of their belief system.
Right.
You pull that linchpin out of the Jenga tower, and Christianity collapses, or so I reasoned. So I really struggled with that. I defended the resurrection of Jesus in a paper because there are historical critical arguments that support the historicity of particularly the empty tomb. But the arguments on the other side are as compelling, if not more compelling. And that's simply this, Justin. It's the dating of the New Testament. Paul is prior. Mm-hmm. Paul writes earlier than the Gospels. You know that.
Mm-hmm.
And Paul's earliest writings are probably mid-40s. The first Gospel, Mark, is about 70. And this is a settled matter among New Testament scholars. The dating of the New Testament is not up for grabs. From Wheaton to Harvard, from Yale to Mars Hill University, the dating of the New Testament is a settled matter. So why is that a problem? Well, the problem is Paul, writing in 1 Corinthians 15, and defending Jesus' resurrection, does not appeal to the empty tomb. That's a problem. If you're making an argument defending the resurrection of Jesus and you don't use the empty tomb, is it because you don't think it's necessary to the argument? Why would you not use that? It's a powerful, probably the most compelling piece of evidence. Are you not aware of the empty tomb story? A story of that magnitude would be known throughout the lands, or, and here's the scholarly rub, had it not been invented yet.
Right.
And that is where, for me, everything started falling apart. That simple problem involving the dating of the New Testament is where my faith really began to collapse. And it is a slippery slope. And by the way, there's nothing wrong with a slippery slope. You know, slippery slope arguments don't always end up in dangerous places. For me, once I reconciled the resurrection problem and said, no, I see the issue, and I don't think this story is true. Now, there are many ministers who don't believe in the literal resurrection. And you'll hear in sermons, they'll use the resurrection as a metaphor. They'll use the empty tomb story as a launching pad, but you can tell they don't think it's literally true. But that then began posing other questions for me, namely, what about God? Mm-hmm. Is God, using Bultmann's demythology, is God simply the product of a myth? And that's when my beliefs about view of God begin to really seriously erode. And I didn't arrive at atheism, not that there's anything wrong with atheism, to quote Seinfeld. I arrived at a place, as I just said, where I reached the conclusion personally, I don't know that there is a God. I don't think we can know. And I'm comfortable with not knowing. I'm comfortable with the mystery that presents itself to us as life.
All right. So I'm going to push back on that definition of atheist and agnostic.
Please.
Because that's the Christian version of what those terms mean. If you talk to people in the atheist community, for the most part, people are both atheist and agnostic. Atheist is, do you believe in a God? And if you don't know if there's a God, you probably don't believe in a God. And they're different answers to different questions.
I think that's fair. And you've probably, I think it was Richard Dawkins or Christopher Hitchens, but the famous saying, you know, atheists are just like Christians who reject, or Jews who reject, the hundreds of gods that have preceded Yahweh. We just go one God farther.
Yeah.
And actually, Dustin, in my book, I quote extensively Robert Ingersoll, who was a famed atheist agnostic writer. And Ingersoll actually says there is no difference between the two terms, that an atheist is an agnostic is an atheist. So I would agree with you. I was just, for your sake, trying to elaborate on kind of my thought process, right, and the language that I used to describe it.
Yeah. And you're definitely would be more of a soft atheist, because that's also an interesting distinction, soft atheist versus hard atheist.
Yeah, soft atheist or a hard agnostic. Yeah.
Whereas I'm more of a hard atheist. I am convinced that there is no God. Whether or not there's a chance that there is a deistic God is possible, but completely irrelevant. But any kind of like Christian God, there is zero evidence of a God that, based on the stories, there should be ridiculous amounts of evidence.
Absolutely. And Dustin, if you take the biblical God, I mean, and that's the God that's presented to us, correct?
Yeah.
That God is not much of a God. He brags about bashing babies' heads into rocks in Psalms. I mean, the flood story, which you and I probably both heard as a child, which is presented as this wonderful story where the rainbow is at the end that says God will never destroy the land. What about the first time that he did it? There were children, if that story is true. Yeah. There were babies. There were innocent people, all because God gets pissed off. That's a horrible story. So if you accept the God that's presented in the Bible, that's a God that should be rejected, if that, in fact, is God.
Right. And then you get to like the deistic God, which ends up being somebody who would be so abstract and pointless to not be worthy of any praise or acknowledgement or worship or anything, if that was a God that did exist.
Yeah, the God that, you know, wound the universe up and flung it into the universe to let it run a bit on its own. That God is also to be not pitied, but to be scorned. Yeah. Because, okay, he creates it and walks away. So, you know, COVID, what do you do with COVID? So, okay, God, you if you're omnipotent, you should and can be able to do something. Are you not able? Or are you willing but not able? Then if you're willing but not able, then you're a dick. And by the way, the next to last chapter in my book, I examine the book of Job. And the title of that chapter is The Book of Job, : This God Has a Gambling Problem and He's a Dick.
Oh, that's awesome.
I mean, Dustin, think about the story.
Yeah.
You know, the Satan, who is not the Satan of the New Testament, he's the Hebrew word is the prosecutor. So he roamed in the mythology of that time. He roams the earth looking for examples of righteousness. So he approaches God in the story, and God says, hey, how about my boy Job there? Oh, the guy with a beautiful wife and children and 100 camels, take it away from him. He'll curse you to his face. And God says, I'll take that bet. And so the Satan proceeds to utterly ruin Job's life. And Job is innocent, and he knows that. The reader knows he's innocent. God knows he's innocent. And he protests, and his friends say, well, you know, if you'll just confess your sin, you've done something wrong, because it was believed that bad things happen to bad people, good things happen to good people. That was the Deuteronomistic theology of that time. But Job protests his innocence. And once God has a chance to speak, what does God say? Where the hell were you when I created the world? You piss ant. You know, and he actually says, brace it, Job. Take it like a man. Yeah. What kind of God? I mean, that sounds more like Donald Trump than God. And you know, Christians and Jews have attempted to whitewash that story to somehow make God look good. And many scholars believe that the ending of that story, where everything gets wrapped up with a bow, Job gets his family and children back, but not new ones. I mean, they're new, not the old ones, because the old ones are dead. Everything gets restored. And again, some scholars believe that was an appendage to really make this unsavory story look good. But that story on its face is just a really horrible story. And that God is a really horrible God.
Yeah, like literally dozens of people and hundreds or thousands of animals killed for a bet.
Yeah, a bet. A bet. Yeah.
I've read, back in my theology student days, I read a number of different ways that people tried to clean up that story. And it all comes down to, if the Christian God is all-knowing, all-powerful, and also loving, that story can't be correct.
No.
One of those is wrong.
Yeah, and the other thing, too, some scholars believe the Book of Job was based upon a Sumerian prototype. So it's arguably not even an original story. But that aside, it's really not a flattering sight of God. And it's amazing, Dustin, the lengths to which believers go to somehow justify that God or redeem that God or whitewash that God. And you were about to say, you can't put lipstick on that pig. It's just a really, really ugly, ugly story. That even if you take the appendage of where, okay, Job gets everything restored, but he suffered unnecessarily all because of a bet. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And because God's a dick. God in that story is a dick.
And it makes sense that Job got into the Bible and stayed in the Bible, because a asshole God is consistent with the entire rest of the Bible.
Yeah. So the Book of Job is part of what scholars consider the wisdom literature. The Psalms are included in that, the Book of Ecclesiastes, the Book of Job. And those writers, interestingly, were pushing back on this Deuteronomistic theology, this worldview that said good things happen to good people and bad things happen to bad people. But Dustin, concomitant with that worldview was an afterlife worldview in which it was believed everyone went to the same place when they died, which is Sheol in the Hebrew. There is no hell. There's no Hebrew word for hell in the Old Testament. There's only one word. It's Sheol. Sheol was this shadowy, nebulous place or state of being where everyone went when he or she died. But there's a problem. There's a problem if you start to push back on the notion that good things happen to good people and bad things happen to bad people, and everybody goes to the same place when they die. Some writers said, no, it's not the case. Bad things can happen to good people, and good things can happen to bad people. And that was what the wisdom writers started to present. You see that in Job. Mm-hmm. You certainly see it in Ecclesiastes. Time and chance happen to them all is a great verse there. But that presents a problem. So if bad things can happen to good people in this life, and good things can happen to bad people, but everybody goes to the same place, you have an imbalance of the divine scales of justice. And guess what happens, Dustin, around 200 BC? You have a bifurcation of the afterlife.
Yeah.
You have this bifurcation. Some scholars believe that it was imported from Persia. But regardless, you now see, okay, so bad people go to a different place when they die. And by the time you get into the New Testament, you have this word Gehenna. The Greek word for hell is Gehenna, but Gehenna was not a part of a myth. It was a literal place outside of Jerusalem. It was a garbage dump where fires would just smolder continually, and it actually had been a place where children were sacrificed, you know, hundreds of years ago. So when Jesus said it would be better to be thrown into hell or Gehenna than to mislead a child, people would have said, "Oh, Gehenna, the garbage dump, the smoldering garbage dump." And it would be years later when that would become part of the mythology of, you know, this full blown afterlife with a heaven and a hell. Did that make sense? That what I just kind of walked through.
From my study, and of course with the Adventist background on that, with that being that there is no, that hell is not a literal place. Adventists only believe there is a heaven, and if you don't go there, you just don't exist. And you can easily read the Bible with that as the conclusion, because Sheol you can just view as the grave, not an afterlife, just everybody dies.
Yeah.
And it's just as consistent to look at it that way. And the New Testament talks about heaven. The wordage about a hell is all a lot more literal. You're going to have some suffering, but it's not consistent necessarily with an afterlife as a part of that.
Yeah, I think we get more of our concepts of hell from Dante's Inferno than mm-hmm. we do, you know, the Bible. But, you know, my point is simply this. I think that heaven and hell, to me, are clearly literary constructs.
Oh, yeah.
That were created by people to try to make sense of an afterlife. And even, you know, take the afterlife as a subject matter. You know, I remain agnostic about it, probably more atheistic about an afterlife than a God. I think this is it. But I will tell you this, Dustin, and I say this, I write about this in my epilogue. While I was writing my book, my mother died. She died January 1st, a year ago. And it was a very difficult experience. My dad died when I was 12, and that's also part of my story. Probably the beginning of my movement toward a career in ministry and agnosticism. Mm-hmm. It's different losing a mom who's 85 and I was 58 at the time, but you might be surprised. And I say this in the epilogue, I planned the service. There were Christian songs. There was scripture that was read by my daughters and my sister's children. And I delivered the eulogy that had, I won't say had religious themes, but here's my point, Dustin, about the afterlife. You know, I can listen to certain religious music and be moved to tears. "Will the Circle Be Unbroken" is an old gospel song that I love to imagine being reunited with my dad and my mom. It's a wonderful sentiment. Do I think that is going to happen? Do I believe that? No. But I can hold that hope, that fantasy, in tension with my intellectual disbelief in those topics, and be okay with that. And that's kind of what my mom's funeral was about. It was intellectually, I rejected the premises of everything that was said and done, including, and I won't say including my eulogy, because I didn't sacrifice my integrity intellect there. But I was moved to tears. And today I can still be moved by music or literature. And those aren't necessarily religious sentiments. I mean, you can be moved to tears by a great piece of work or music. You know, religion doesn't own the market for sentimentality or for emotion. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. 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 And it's one that I went through when my grandparents died shortly after I left the church and became an atheist. And it was interesting seeing the non-believers in the family versus the believers in the family grieving. And the grief seemed to be easier for the atheists in the family, that we knew it was done, it was over, you move on with life. But I also viewed it in a literary metaphor, as these were people with stories who came to an end. And the story ended. And like in the case of my grandpa, my grandparents had been married for 70 years. My grandpa got to die in the house he built with four of his five children standing around him. And he just talked to the fifth on the phone. He'd gotten to see his great-great-grandchildren. You know, you don't get a better ending to a story than that.
No.
That's not sad that the story ends. The story has to end.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it, Dustin. And what a remarkable story. And what a remarkable ending. But you and I know not all stories end well.
Right.
You know, and COVID has taught, if nothing has taught us that, COVID has. But our lives are stories. And we all have stories. And, you know, part of my orientation to life and part of my trying to understand other people, particularly in the business world, because I'm now in that world, is tell me your story. Mm-hmm. You know, when someone tells their story, you see that we're more than Republicans and Democrats and theists and atheists and agnostics. We're people with stories. And some stories are fascinating. Some are tragic. Some are sad. Some end incredibly well and beautifully, like your grandfather's, and some less so. But viewed that way, life is a story. I think is a great way to approach life and to look at, you know, the afterlife or thoughts as a metaphor or as a way to think, you know, differently. I'm fine with that. I can fantasize about seeing my dad again, and I can cry about that. But I can also intellectually say, I don't think that's going to happen. Pretty sure it's not going to happen. But I can live in the beauty of the metaphor and let that wash over me. And there's something healing about that. And, it, you know, at age 59, 47 years later, you know, I still think about him and not as often. And I can be moved to tears and I can even fantasize about a hug, you know, or spending an hour or 30 more minutes. And that's perfectly compatible with my intellectual rejection of that same notion.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, I've also experienced, had losses that didn't work as well with the story. My nephew who died of a drug overdose at 21, that sucked, but he had a sad story that ended sadly. When I found out my estranged father had died, I wanted to fill in the previous, you know, the last 20 years, couldn't really find much. And that sucks.
Yeah. One of the points of my book, and if you even just skim the chapters beyond the first two, I take on a lot of popular religious notions, some of which aren't even in the Bible, but, you know, everything happens for a reason is a chapter of mine. Mm-hmm. God has a plan for your life is a chapter. It was his time to go is a chapter. The God who protects ... until he doesn't is a chapter, because some of the stories that, like the ones you've just mentioned, a 20-year-old dying of an overdose, squared with everything happens for a reason, really? It was his time to go. I mean, what do you do with a death of a 3-year-old child and it was his time to go? Because it's either your time to go or it's not. And I really fleshed that out in a chapter. And some of the stories, like the ones you just described, they really should bury some of these notions that we both hear every day. Probably a day doesn't go by or a week doesn't go by when I don't hear everything happens for a reason. Really, really. Tell me the reason behind COVID. Yep. You know, tell me the reason behind 9/11. And I talk about it in the book. I think that people say that and believe that, because to believe otherwise is to really acknowledge the role that chance plays in life. And it's like being on an existential tightrope without a safety net, that's life.
It's actually worse than that. It's you try to simplify it and take away needing to find the actual reasons why it happened. There are actual reasons why COVID happened. And we need to look at those reasons and try to figure out how to keep the next coronavirus from causing the next pandemic.
But if you're looking for this theological, God has a plan, or God sent this to, when you take God out of it and just look at it practically and factually and scientifically, yes, you can dissect it and figure out, okay, what happened here, why, and what can we do? But the notion that somehow God is tied to this, to me, just is absurd. And if that's how God works, mm-hmm. I want nothing to do with that kind of God.
Well, and then when you look at how a lot of believers are handling it, is either, nope, this isn't happening, it's not real, or, nope, this is the sign of the times, and this is what's going to bring about Armageddon.
Yeah, I think there's another tint to it, Dustin, that I'm trying to write an op-ed around. I think there's a parallel between the people that don't wear masks and the magical thinking of believers. You know, God's got me. God's protecting me. I pray for protection. And guess what? I'm alive and it's worked. So I don't need to wear a mask because God's my mask. Kind of like the God is my co-pilot kind of thing. I think there's some parallels there in thinking.
A few weeks ago, we covered a news story with a televangelist who had said that Jesus is the vaccine.
Yeah.
This was somebody who had just been hospitalized with COVID. And he was telling his congregation, don't worry about it. Jesus is the vaccine. This guy was worried about it in the hospital, getting really good medical care to keep him alive.
Yeah.
Like, how can you be so callous?
Good luck with that vaccine. I'll take science 7 days out of seven and twice on Sunday.
Yeah. Oh man. All right. So going back into your story with, you know, so you made it through your Master of Divinity program with questions that you probably didn't want to have, but they weren't really challenging your faith yet.
They weren't challenging the God part of faith.
Yeah.
I had made, go ahead, Dustin.
Oh, because you would have still been able to view it as your faith was maturing as you were learning what parts are bullshit and what you're getting is more pure and better. And
I had made peace with Christianity. I had done what Bultmann did. I demythologized the New Testament, much like Thomas Jefferson did, by the way, which left him with a New Testament that was about yay thin.
Yeah.
And I was okay with that. And as I said earlier, you know, a lot of ministers who go through theological education arrive at similar places, and you just kind of deal with that. You focus on the things that are positive. But the God thing had not really been challenged until, like I said, about 2 years into my second congregation. And that's when those doubts became louder and louder.
What changed?
What changed was going from God as an existential given to God as a big question mark, which is the front of my book.
Yeah.
What changed was going from a dogmatic certainty to an embrace of mystery to being uncomfortable with not knowing. That's what changed. And you know, did it happen overnight? No, but it was kind of an epiphany. And I don't think the word epiphany is exclusively in the domain of religious language. I think we can have epiphanies. We can have existential epiphanies. And that's kind of where I ended up. It was just a gradual unfolding of, I don't know, and I don't think I can know, and I'm uncomfortable not knowing. And as I said earlier, once you arrive at that position, the very next thing you say is utterly, necessarily, inescapably conjecture.
Yeah. Because at that point, you'd have gone for several years with doing weddings and funerals and pastoral counseling and preaching every week and people wanting the answers from you. And you reached the point where you started to not have the answers.
Yeah, I will tell you this, though, Dustin. So, and I think I said earlier, you know, I was not afraid to take scholarship into the pulpit. And I said more than once to my congregations, you know, Socrates said an unexamined life is not worth living. And I would always say an unexamined faith is not worth having. I would challenge my congregation to think critically about scripture. One Easter Sunday, which, as you know, is the packed house. It's when everybody shows up. You've got a big captive audience. I essentially deconstructed Jesus' resurrection on Easter Sunday. I said it like this. You need to know the other side of this story, because there is another side of the story. This morning, I'm going to be an attorney. I'm going to present the argument for the prosecution, and I'm going to present the argument for the defense. And then I'm going to kind of put a bow on it at the end. And I'm satisfied, Dustin, no one in that congregation had ever heard the other side of the story. Yeah. And I am satisfied. I am one of very, very few ministers who's ever done that, who ever had the balls to do that.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was some risk in that, even though the church where I was at the time had a very free pulpit. And that was very important. There really wasn't much that I could or couldn't say there. And I had members who came up afterwards, one particular member, an attorney and a CPA, who said, I never knew the other side, and I'm so glad you presented it. Mm-hmm. But that was my approach. I was intellectually honest to the extent that I could be. Now, I did not reveal my struggles those last 2 years, but Dustin, I say this in my book, if anybody had been paying attention, they would have noticed my utter reticence in talking about God. My prayers became vague and vapid. Mm-hmm. God almost disappeared from my sermons. They were almost exclusively existential. But having said that, and I say this in my book, Dustin, I had a professor at Duke and I had a professor at Princeton that were really my sounding board because, you know, I had no one to talk to. My wife at the time knew what I was going through. I had some ministerial colleagues who did. But I had a professor, a mentor at Duke and at Princeton who said, the church needs your voice. And they had likened it to the theologian Paul Tillich. And I'm not sure if you've ever read Tillich, mm-hmm. but, you know, Tillich went from talking about God as a being unto God's self, but as the ground of being. And that's kind of the Tillich, the ground of being. And that's kind of where I was, that God was being itself, not a being. And they were like, Dave, your worldview, there's nothing wrong with it. My comeback to them was, that's easy for you to say from the ivory tower. You don't have to stand up in front of people every Sunday who probably don't approach God like that and who don't see God, you know, in those terms.
Right. Right. And it's an interesting kind of, it's interesting to see the difference between, like, I wasn't able to, as I started to doubt things, I wasn't able to make the move to existentialism, existential Christianity. Like, I could not handle that. It had to be real. It had to be literal. It had to actually be something, or it's all bullshit, was my take. You made the shift to an existential form of Christianity, and I had some professors I talked to in the seminary that had, they were talking about some of the same kind of doubts that I was going through, and I got some one-on-one meetings with them, and they had all ended up at that same place as well. What's crazy was one of them, he told me that he does not necessarily believe there is a God. He does not necessarily believe any of it, but he accepts it on an existential reason so he can live his life, and he thinks that it provides value for him. He regularly argues against evolution.
Wow.
And he doesn't necessarily believe, he doesn't actually believe it, but he will argue creationism.
Wow. That seems to be very contradictory, but interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's weird to see that, like, there are people who can take that existential Christianity and live a, some can do it well and live an authentic life, and some can do it poorly and live a double life.
Yeah. So the difference I would argue, Dustin, is it's one thing to do that from the pew mm-hmm. when you don't have your livelihood tied to what you're doing. When you are paid to do what I was doing as a minister, it's an entirely different proposition, in my opinion. I said on another podcast, you know, Christianity for some, it's like a parlor game. It's nice. It's personal. But you know what? You don't have much tied to it. You know, your profession's not tied to it. I say in my book, when I started really, really having the louder doubts about God, you know, it was like a professional baseball pitcher losing his fastball, or an opera singer losing her voice, or a pilot losing his or her vision. You can still fly a plane, but you're probably going to crash. You can still throw a strike, but you're probably going to get hit out of the park. And it's just a different thing when it is, when you are a minister and it is your profession and this is happening. And Dustin, going back in time, there wasn't an internet. Mm-hmm. I thought I was the only minister in the world who was losing his faith. I was driving out of town to see a psychologist because everybody knew me in this town, only to be told, no, Dave, you're not losing your mind. This actually happens. And then ironically and interestingly and wonderfully, that same year, 1996, John Updike released a novel called In the Beauty of the Lilies. And it's a story about a Presbyterian minister who loses his faith and enters the world of sales. And that was the only salvific thing for me at the time, because, like I said, no internet, no clergy mm-hmm. project that's funded by the Lilly Foundation. I knew that Updike, in telling this story, either was feeling this himself or he had talked to ministers who were going through this.
Yeah.
Because that he go in those first two or three chapters of that novel, he goes into great detail about that minister's struggle. And it was like reading my own thoughts. But at the time, I thought I was all alone. And that is really the singular reason I wrote this book, is that if there's another minister out there going through what I did, who can read my book and go, I'm not alone. That's mm-hmm. It's worth it. I do think there's a larger audience. I think there are more people out there who have doubts than would acknowledge, mm-hmm. because it's not popular to acknowledge doubts or to say you're agnostic. But I think they're out there. And
yeah.
Yeah.
You know, in my time in the seminary, it was in various classes. It was interesting looking around where classmates and I would exchange glances of basically acknowledging that, oh yeah, this is all crazy. What the hell are we doing here? And a lot of them are pastors now. And it's how do you make, when you keep down that path, it's like,
I have a kind of a built-in bullshit detector. If you plop me into any church on a Sunday, I'll get more narrow, a moderate, you know, Presbyterian Methodist Baptist church, and give me about five sermons to listen to, I can probably tell you where that minister's coming from with respect to whether he believes in a literal God or not, whether he believes in the literal story of Christianity. They're more out there than you realize. And here's the other problem, Dustin. I was 35 when I walked away, and I didn't know what I was going to do, but I knew it wasn't that. I had colleagues who said, I don't know what else I would do. Mm-hmm. And those are the ones that stay. And by the time, you know, you get into your 50s and you have something like this happen, you really don't have many career options. You know, you're at an age where, you know, you're not desirable. No one can say that. But, you know, there are certain, you know, silent discriminatory forces out there when you reach a certain age. I was 35. I didn't know what I would do. But as long as I had a brain and a mouth, I would find a way to make money. And I've done very well. I've been very fortunate in the last, 24 years, to do some of the things I've done. And I'm at a really good place. But ministers out there, mm-hmm. who I'm satisfied are millimeters away from the conversation that you and I are having, but their career options are limited. Yeah. And so they just kind of make that intellectual sacrifice. They kind of go along. They existentialize sermons and prayers. There's kind of a wink and a nod. Not necessarily with their congregations, but to themselves. And they're more out there than you would realize.
Yeah. Functioning more as a inspirational speaker and counselor than a pastor, which can actually, I'm sure there's a lot who do that and still feel very satisfied that they're doing the right thing.
And Dustin, I'm not sitting in judgment on those people at all. Because I know where they're coming from. And I do think it's possible to be an effective minister with that, you know, call it liberal worldview. You can still be with people in the liminal moments of life, births, deaths, tragedy. You can minister to people. You can lead a congregation. It's tough. It's difficult. And the difficulty for me in this second church was compounded by the fact that this church was declining, and it had been for some time. It was once this vibrant, big downtown congregation that in the early 70s split overnight over the issue of race. You may find this hard to believe, but up until the early 70s, this congregation had a clause in its constitution that forbade blacks from entering the building.
Oh, wow.
And students would protest on the steps of this church. Up until the church split, ostensibly again over race, it was more than that. And within a matter of months, that clause was stricken from the Constitution. And by the time I got to the congregation, I saw no vestiges of racism. And this was in an area, by the way, Prince Edward County in Virginia, that was one of the precursors to the Brown versus Board of Education landmark Supreme Court. And in this particular town, when they were told to desegregate the schools, public schools in Farmville, Virginia were closed for at least five and maybe more years. And if you were an African American in that time, unless you had relatives outside of that area, you were not educated.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. At the same time, a private academy was birthed, and it met in the basement of churches. So, you know, that what I just described about this congregation was part of a larger dynamic unfolding, you know, in that area. But yeah, so back to where, you know, I entered the picture, you know, a sanctuary that seats, you know, 800, you know, was no longer full. And every morning from the time that I preached my trial sermon, which is when they bring you in and they vote on you, mm-hmm. to my last Sunday, people were craning their necks and counting bodies. And there was a palpable anxiety there that certainly didn't help matters with me as the last 2 years as I was losing, you know, my faith. But I will tell you this, Dustin. So last year, I made 15 times my best year as a minister, and I had 1/15 the pressure.
Yeah.
Just let that kind of sink in. And the more important data point there is not the 15 times the income, but 1/15 the pressure. And I work for one of the largest companies on the planet. And I've worked for other large companies, and I've had you know, jobs that you know, were pretty pressure filled and high profile. I've never felt the pressure like growing a congregation that was declining and losing your faith while you're doing that.
Yep. Yeah, and I can't quite relate to the pressure, but I can relate to the last time I preached was an evangelistic series in Mexico, and I got 4 sermons in and I called it quits and walked away. That 4th sermon was supposed to be the altar call, and I did the altar call and I half-assed it because I didn't believe it. I hadn't believed a single word that had come out of my mouth that entire time I was there. And the next morning, hearing the other seminary students who were preaching at the other sites in the area, they all had people coming forward at the altar call. I was the only one who didn't. And it was at that point I was able to recognize, if I'm right, I'm not doing anybody any favors. If I'm wrong, I'm also not doing anybody any favors. And
yeah, my congregations were much more modern. We did not have altar calls. It's odd. In the state of Virginia, the Baptist churches, for the large part, are pretty moderate. I think some of that was the Anglican influence. So, for example, you know, in my second church, we rode, you know, during the worship service. We observed the liturgical calendar. It was a very formal service. So there was an altar call. If I had issued an altar call, that would have gotten me fired before any other, you know, other thing, because they would have been like, what in the hell is he doing? I didn't have to live with that. And I can safely say that I didn't sacrifice my intellect or my integrity those entire 4 years. I remained faithful to myself. I remained faithful to as much of the gospel as I could without lying. I mean, I never preached anything that, certainly, you know, the hellfire and brimstone was never part of who I was. I was always more on the humanist side, you know, of Jesus and focused there. But that's an interesting story. I don't think I've ever given an altar call in my life.
Well, and it was that series was a completely scripted, the laptop that was provided for it had a special program they had developed that did the slideshow in English on the screen, but you connected it to the projector and the projector got Spanish. And I had a translator. And so I had to stay on script. Otherwise, the slides wouldn't make any sense. And so they do that to make sure the people they have preaching so they don't go off script. And it was really interesting going through it, seeing how formulaic it was, where, yes, if you can convince people of one thing in the first sermon and one thing in the second sermon and one thing in the third sermon, the conclusion of the 4th sermon is to come forward for the altar call. But I couldn't even convince myself of those.
This is like a prepackaged meal.
Yeah.
You eat this, you eat this, you eat this, and here's the dessert.
Yeah. Well, and now you work in sales. It was a completely prepackaged sales call.
Yeah, and the last sermon is the close. You're closing for the order.
Oh, no, that was only the fourth out of 27.
Oh, okay.
After you get that to that point, then you build on to all the rest till you, at the very end, have people not working on Saturday and giving 10% of all their money to the church and not eating pork and, if possible, going vegetarian. And you get all these other things added in there, too. Oh, quitting drinking and smoking and, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, those were, you know, the drinking is my congregations would have run me out if I had ever taken on any of those. And I will say this, Dustin, this might give you a sense of kind of what I was like as a minister. The highest compliment that anybody could ever have paid me when I was a minister was, I can't believe you're a minister, because I have never acquired a taste for alcohol. But if I were in a social setting and it was there, I would, you know, I'd nurse a beer. I would have a drink just to let people know it's okay. If I was on the golf course, I might drop an F-bomb just to let you know, yeah, I can get pissed off. And there's nothing wrong with, you know, profanity. I mean, I didn't have a potty mouth. And I think there were many people who found comfort in that, because they saw me as being real and they could come into my study and tell me their real kind of things. There were a few, not many, but a few that always wanted, you know, the minister to be in role. I'm using air quotes here. But I was never in role when I was in role. I never talked with an affected accent. I never prayed in an affected accent. I was myself. And oddly enough, to this day, when I meet people and they, you know, hear that I was a minister, like, no effing way you're a minister. And I'm like, yeah, effing way I was a minister. Yeah, I mean, that's because my two selves were very congruent.
Yeah.
If that tells you about the sacrifices that I didn't make as a person,
yep,
you know, when I was a minister.
And the fact that you were able to do that would have made that process a lot easier and allowed you to go slower.
Yeah. I mean, again, both congregations were pretty mature in terms of, you know, their health, that they weren't in turmoil. In my first congregation, there was some theological diversity, and that could pose challenges. And there was socioeconomic diversity there. I had in that first congregation one of the heiresses to the Anheuser-Busch fortune. She was Sally Bush Wheeler. In fact, they paid for my Princeton education. I used to tell my friends at Princeton, Budweiser funded my doctoral study at Princeton. My second congregation was much more homogenous socioeconomically and theologically. It was a very, I won't say liberal, that's not fair, but it was a moderate to liberal Baptist church. And it allowed me to be myself. And it allowed to what you just said, for things to unfold slowly. But at some point, I realized I just can't do this. I have to walk away.
So liberal Baptist or moderate Baptist is something that may be surprising for some people.
Like oxymoronic.
Yeah. Were your churches part of the Southern Baptist Convention?
Great question. Historically, yes. But, you know, when I was a minister, the Southern Baptist Convention was fracturing. And it was literally coming apart, which is one of the reasons that I chose Duke for my master's degree. I was at the time one of five Baptist students at Duke. I wanted to see how other people taught and thought about religious matters. So going to Duke, if I were to even consider being a Baptist minister, going to Duke would really alienate me from the network, the good old boy network.
Mm-hmm.
But the Southern Baptist Convention was splintering, and both of my churches eventually ended up going with a more moderate side of the convention.
Okay.
And I wouldn't have even considered, nor would a fundamentalist church have considered me, chiefly for having gone to Duke. That eliminated a lot of your churches. But no, there are, out there in the Baptist land, there are moderate to liberal Baptist churches. The church that my family attends in another city is not only the most liberal Baptist church in that city, it's the most liberal church in that city. They have a lesbian staff member who's married and they have children. They have deacons who are gay and lesbian. It is not a don't ask, don't tell. It is a you tell us who we are and we will welcome you and we will put you in positions of leadership. They're an outlier. I would submit they're an outlier, but there are a handful of those churches out there. And some were in between the spectrum of moderate to liberal, but it does surprise some people when they hear the term liberal Baptist, right. Because it's not their grandmother's Baptist church.
Well, and it is worth noting that every Baptist church is technically independent,
whether or not
it's a part of a convention or not.
Yeah, Baptist churches are highly autonomous. They govern themselves. They hire and fire their staff. They make their own decisions. There's no ecclesiastical body above them telling them what to do, how to do it, whom to hire. But having said that, there is some wisdom. Say, for example, the Methodist Church. If you're a minister in a Baptist church and, you piss a handful of people off and those people are influential, they can make your life miserable. And they can actually they can affect your ouster. And I saw that. It luckily didn't happen to me. And if that happens to a Baptist minister, you wear the scarlet letter. You're really marked. And it's very difficult to recover from that. In a Methodist church, when there is conflict between the minister and the congregation, which inevitably happens, it happens everywhere, some sooner than later, you have a district superintendent from the conference that comes in, tries to mediate, and if the differences cannot be resolved, that minister simply is moved to another congregation, and another minister comes in behind that one, and life goes on.
Yep.
So, Baptists would always tout and we're very proud of their, the autonomy of the local church and the autonomy of the believer. And there's value in that. But when you're a minister in that system, there's a lot of exposure because there is no one protecting you from that congregation other than yourself. One of the many reasons I was attracted to the autonomy of the Baptist church at the time, because I had the dean of the Divinity School at Duke, Dr. Dennis Campbell, who became a friend and a mentor and was trying to recruit me always into becoming a Methodist. He wrote a book called The Yoke of Obedience, and he asked me to read it and then talk about it. And so I read it and went into his office, and he goes, well, what do you think? And I said, well, I'm not ready to be yoked. Because in that system, you kind of have to wait for the tall steeples. You kind of have to pay your dues. In a Baptist church, if you are, smart and bright and ambitious, you don't have to wait until you're 50 to get into a tall steeple. It's kind of like the free agency market in sport. And I was ambitious, and there's nothing wrong with ambition. And any minister that tells you that they're not ambitious is lying. And I say this in my book, Dustin, in talking about the Baptist church, we talked about churches calling ministers. And when I left my first congregation, I said to them, I'm moving to a larger church in another town making more money. And I said, maybe God is in that. But let me ask you a question. Have you ever heard of God calling a Baptist minister to a smaller church making less money? Funny how that works, isn't it? And I had a Virginia gentleman at the end of that service, as I was shaking people's hands, come up to me and he said, and I quote, Dave, I'm so glad you didn't give us that bullshit about God calling you. And I said, James, and his name was James, I said, maybe God is in it, but let's face it, it's a bigger church and I'm making more money and it's my decision. Again, there's a certain amount of disingenuousness that ministers and churches play in that whole process. The other one is around, growing the church financially, numerically. I don't care what denomination or what church, if you're a minister, you have to do two things. You have to grow the church numerically and financially. You can call it evangelism. You can call it saving souls. But at the end of the day, it looks a lot like a business. And I saw that in both congregations. I see it out there today. You can dress it up. You can call it whatever you want to call it. But those are very real pressures that ministers face. And I face them as well.
Right. And you would have been facing them very directly since those numbers and those finances affected your salary.
Absolutely. It's hard, to ask for a raise if the revenue is not growing or if it's in fact declining. It's still hard for a Baptist minister to get a raise. The Baptist churches, at least in my experience, didn't really do a good job of that. I remember one particular year in my second congregation, the finance committee had proposed modest 2% raises across the staff. And as they were presenting the budget and these 2% raises, which was the first time that that had been proposed when I was there, one particular church member stood up and said, so if we're going to give 2% raises, are we going to get 2% more work? And the dean of the business school at the time was sitting next to me. I'm about to come out of my chair. And he puts his hand on my knee and he goes, Dave, you can't take it personally. I said, there's no other way to take it than personally. Mm-hmm. You know, I may have even said this is bullshit. But it's hard, to ask for a raise when you're not growing.
Yeah. Yeah. Whereas the Adventist church, it's the conference employs the pastors and owns the church building, not the local congregation. And the pastors all make the same salary, but they get car and housing allowances, which can allow them to move to more expensive areas, to the bigger cities with the bigger churches. And where the ambition comes in is start out as a youth pastor or associate pastor, and then you get your own church. Might be that you're having to cover three or four churches, but the goal is to eventually get to where you've got that one church big enough to just be the pastor of one church. Then you need to get to the bigger church where you can get the senior pastor title, so you can then get the conference position, which then puts you in a different pay scale.
Fear of misrepresenting the Methodist conference. That's exactly the way that worked. And I actually, looking back, you know, from a ministerial perspective, I think it's healthier. Yeah, I knew guys and women at Duke, their first job was, they called it a 3-point charge. You had three churches.
Yeah.
You just rotate it, you know, and it's exactly the way you described it. Your goal was then to get in a single church and then in a larger and a larger, but typically the larger churches and the taller steeple were reserved for older tenured ministers, which kind of makes sense. Yeah. I mean, you know, you want your larger congregations to have someone who has experience and wisdom. And, you know, I don't think I was that wise at, you know, 27, 28, 29, when I, you know, was in congregations. I was precocious and mature. But I wanted to get to the tall steeple like now. You know, I didn't want to have to pay my dues. And it was possible. It was possible to get into a very tall steeple in your 30s if you were good. You didn't have to wait. The problem is, if there was conflict and if you had to leave, there was no safety net. You didn't have the conference to come in and intervene. And that's, to me, the beauty of the system that you just described and the system of the United Methodist Church.
And I
can say that without, you know, any bias.
One of the flaws I saw in the Adventist Church with that system is if you don't make it up in your 30s, you won't. If you've still got two churches when you turn 40, you will still have, you might get down to just having one church by the time you retire.
I think that's fair, Dylan. And I suspect that dynamic is true in the Methodist Church. But, you know, also, to a different degree, true in the Baptist church, you know, by a certain age, if you were not in, you know, a certain size congregation, it was highly unlikely that you were going to be, you know, to get there. Number one, your age would, because, you know, churches probably to this day still want a younger minister with a family who can attract young families. Mm-hmm. That was the case when I was doing it. It's still the case now from what I'm reading. But in the Baptist church, if you know, by the time you reached, you know, your 40s, if you weren't in a certain kind of church, you probably weren't going to get that church.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, I think we're out of time. So where can people find your book?
They can go to Amazon and you can either Google the title, Speaking of God, We Don't Know Shit. You can go to my website, dbramsey.com. Right. That's dbramsey.com. And they can order from the website. So those are two easy ways to do it.
All right. I'll have links in the show notes.
Thank you, Dustin.
Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Dustin. I really enjoyed our time.
Well, I hope you enjoyed the interview. Don't forget, we have a live stream coming up on December 20 at
2 o'clock p.m. Mountain Standard Time. If you want to contact us, you can use the contact form on the website. You can use the SpeakPipe link to leave us a voice message, or you can just shoot us an email at contact@atheistnomads.com. If you'd like to support the show, you can find out how at atheistnomads.com/donate. And until next week, remember, not all those who wander are lost.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Atheist Nomads. You can find show notes and contact information at atheistnomads.com. Follow us on Twitter at Atheist Nomads and like us on Facebook at facebook.com/atheistnomads. Please subscribe to the show in iTunes, Stitcher, or your podcatcher of choice. And while you're there, feel free to leave us a review. Theme music is courtesy of Sturdy Fred. Until next time, this has been the Atheist Nomads.